We're going to be joined here in just one moment by Selwyn Duke. He's also with The New American, just like Veronica. We're going to play some audio clips from the very historic case that was before the U.S. Supreme Court today that could overturn Roe v. Wade. We'll hear audio clips from, look, there she's turned around now, so you can see a little bit of her face. We need to get our Delta cam pushed back her way. But we're going to play some audio clips of Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Barrett. And I think by their comments, we might actually see Roe v. Wade turned over, overruled. It's going to be very interesting to watch this, isn't it? So we're going to play some of those clips for you here in just 1 minute. Selwyn Duke, welcome back to the broadcast. Thank you for joining us.
To be with you again, as always. And I saw good old Robert Spencer there. He does a lot of good work.
Yes, he does do a lot of good work, as do you. And let's go to the case related to the Supreme Court. We have some audio I'm going to play here in just 1 second. First, let's start out with this of Brett Kavanaugh, because Brett Kavanaugh was talking about the issue of basically precedent. Now, I'm not a big fan of precedent, because precedent is also referred to as case law theory, I believe. And we know that in the early 1920s, Christopher Columbus Langdow came up with the idea of case law theory. I write about this in my book, Grave Influence, subtitled 21 Radicals Ruling America from the Grave. We sold thousands and thousands of copies of that. That's one of my most popular books I've ever written. It came out in 2009. I wrote it in 2008. And when the paper crisis gets under control, I'm going to republish it this next time as a paperback instead of hardcover. And I'm going to drop the price like a stone, like I did Marxianity, so we can disseminate more copies. Because I think it's one of the most important books you could read, not because I wrote it, but because of the research that's in there. 21 Radicals Ruling America from the Grave. You can find it still as a hardcover at wvwtv.com/store. wvwtv.com/store. If you're a member of my VIP club at situationroom.net, you not only have access to thousands and thousands of my radio shows over the years, and TV shows, ebooks, audiobooks, documentaries, but as I said, ebooks. You'll have the ebook of Grave Influence as well as the audiobook of Grave Influence when you're a member of my VIP club at situationroom.net, situationroom.net. But Christopher Columbus Langdow taught the idea of case law theory. All you got to do is get a judge to rule, and then you start building future cases on that case law theory, and that's also known as legal positivism. Legal positivism is also in that, and that's moral relativism applied to the law. So get one guy to make a stupid ruling, hang your hat on it, and now we're off to basing law on man's opinion versus the original intent of the founders. So I find it interesting that Kavanaugh is saying, well, it's okay to overrule precedent, because I think it's showing us the need to not worry about what someone has already ruled in the past, case law theory, but what is the clear intent of the Constitution? You want to comment before we go to this first clip by Justice Kavanaugh?
Yeah, well, absolutely. We have to understand what ultimately precedes. Now, if you're talking about morality, then the ultimate precedent is God's law, right? That's what you've got to look to. If you're talking about the legal realm, then in our country, you're looking to the Constitution.
If you believe William Blackstone, who said a constitutional republic is based on the law of the divine.
It is, yeah. But, of course, the Constitution is silent on many things, no doubt about that. But, you know, Jonathan Swift, the Anglo-Irish satirist, almost 300 years ago mocked this idea of precedent. Back then they had this problem, and basically what he said was, I'm paraphrasing, that lawyers have this idea that if something has been done before, it may be done again. And on that basis, they justify all manner and form of iniquities.
Wow. All right, let's go to this first clip. This is Justice Kavanaugh, and then we have one by Justice Barrett. Let's play this first one.
If you think about some of the most important cases, the most consequential cases in this court's history, there's a string of them where the cases overruled precedent. Brown v. Board, outlawed separate but equal. Baker versus Carr, which set the stage for one person, one vote. West Coast Hotel, which recognized the state's authority to regulate business. Miranda versus Arizona, which required police to give warnings when the right to about the right to remain silent and to have an attorney present to suspects in criminal custody. Lawrence v. Texas, which said that the state may not prohibit same-sex conduct. Knapp versus Ohio, which held that the exclusionary rule applies to state criminal prosecutions to exclude evidence obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Gideon versus Wainwright, which guaranteed the right to counsel in criminal cases. Obergefell, which recognized a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. In each of those cases, and that's a list, and I could go on, and those are some of the most consequential and important in the court's history, the court overruled precedent. And it turns out, if the court in those cases had listened and they were presented in with arguments in those cases, adhere to precedent. In Brown v. Board, adhere to Plessy. In West Coast Hotel, adhere to Atkins and adhere to Lochner. And if the court had done that in those cases, the country would be a much different place. So I assume you agree with most, if not all, the cases I listed there where the court overruled precedent. So the question on stare decisis is why, if, and I know you disagree with what I'm about to say in the if we think that the prior precedents are seriously wrong, if that, why then doesn't the history of this court's practice with respect to those cases tell us that the right answer is actually to return to the position of neutrality and not stick with those precedents in the same way that all those other cases did?
So reading from that, you might think that Kavanaugh is going to overturn this. What do you think?
Yeah, it is somewhat encouraging, Brannon, but not completely encouraging, and I'll tell you why. Now, he's absolutely right about precedent. Listen, unfortunately, precedent, and I don't like this idea of stare decisis, has become a rallying cry of moral cowards in too many cases. And what I mean is that a lot of justices will use precedent as an excuse for perpetuating unconstitutional opinions that happen to be fashionable. All right. But the reason why I don't call it completely encouraging is I didn't hear him there talk about the Constitution. The only precedent that really matters is the Constitution. That's all we have to look to.
Very good point. All right. Let's listen to Amy Coney Barrett. You tell me what you think about her comments today before the she's on the bench and this case was brought to them that could overturn Roe v. Wade. Listen.
So petitioner points out that in all 50 states, you can terminate parental rights by relinquishing a child after abortion. And I think the shortest period might have been 48 hours, if I'm remembering the data correctly. So it seems to me, seen in that light, both Roe and Casey emphasized the burdens of parenting. And insofar as you and many of your amici focus on the ways in which the forced parenting, forced motherhood, would hinder women's access to the workplace and to equal opportunities. It's also focused on the consequences of parenting and the obligations of motherhood that flow from pregnancy. Why don't the safe haven laws take care of that problem? It seems to me that it focuses the burden much more narrowly. There is, without question, an infringement on bodily autonomy, you know, which we have in other contexts like vaccines. However, it doesn't seem to me to follow that pregnancy and then parenthood are all part of the same burden. And so it seems to me that the choice more focused would be between, say, the ability to get an abortion at 23 weeks or the state requiring the woman to go 15, 16 weeks more and then terminate parental rights at the conclusion. Why didn't you address the safe haven laws and why don't they matter?
I think they don't matter for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First, even if some of those laws are new since Casey, the idea that a woman could place a child up for adoption has, of course, been true since Roe. So it's a consideration that the court already had before it when it decided those cases and adhered to the viability line. But in addition, we don't just focus on the burdens of parenting, and neither did Roe and Casey. Instead, pregnancy itself is unique. It imposes unique physical demands and risk on women, and in fact has impact on all of their lives and their ability to care for other children, other family members, on their ability to work. And in particular, in Mississippi, those risks are alarmingly high. It's 75 times more dangerous to give birth in Mississippi than it is to have a pre-viability abortion. And those risks are disproportionately threatening the lives of women of color.
I think she's an absolute liar. I was born in Mississippi. 75% more dangerous to have a child than to have an abortion. Does she not realize the infection rate and the death rate from abortions? And what is that? I mean, again, it's just incredible. But the good news is, it seems again as though Amy Coney Barrett was saying that, wait a minute, this idea that there's the burden of parenthood, that's something she's now questioning. What say you? Because that was what was argued in Roe v. Wade originally, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you this, Brandon. Relative to abortion, giving birth
Logan
is
just
not...
Logan just made a good comment. Wouldn't the death rate from abortion be 100%? So she's concerned about the death rate of the mom. How about the death rate of the child? Boy, somebody's taught you well in there, Logan.
Oh, you just stole my thunder. I'm going to have to come around. But I was just going to say, relative to abortion, childbirth is not 75 times as dangerous for the baby. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
That was my line. But no, I mean, absolutely, it's encouraging what she's saying, but I'm still not hearing talk about the Constitution. And that's what concerns me. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people like to talk about how Clarence Thomas hardly ever talks in court.
Yes.
And I think there's a very good reason for that. He's the best justice we've had in many decades. And there's not much to talk about, Brandon, if you just look at the Constitution, which is the contract that the American people have with one another. You don't need to bloviate on. You don't need to ask a lot of questions. The Constitution is very clear on most things. Look at what it says. And I think that's Clarence Thomas's perspective.
And you know what he said today? Apparently he said today, quote, does a mother have a right to ingest drugs and harm pre-viable baby? Can the state bring child neglect charges against the mother? Question mark. Great question.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, if you look at our laws, you know they're not based on truth because there's too much contradiction. They're very, very schizophrenic. For instance, you've got that example. You also have the fact that if a man kills a pregnant woman, he can be charged with a double murder, as he should be. Yet if that very woman had killed her own baby at the same time, well, that would be absolutely fine. They'd call that a choice, and that doesn't really make any sense at all. Not only that, maybe this is a stretch to some people, but I guess you could make the argument that it's not equal protection under the law for another reason, and that's that you're saying that one person may not kill this unborn individual, but another person may kill this unborn individual. Mm. It's a very interesting thing. But, you know, the reason why I'm not completely encouraged by what I'm hearing, Brandon, is that unfortunately, we see too often that these so-called conservative justices are not constitutionalists. They're conservative, as in being defensive, as in conserving the status quo. And right now, the status quo is Roe. Too many of these people are really afraid to pull the trigger when it comes to overturning these ridiculous long-standing precedents. But notice, Brandon, people on the left are never shy about that. They have this revolutionary mindset that just says, hey, the end justifies the means. You do whatever you have to do to advance your agenda. So-called conservatives don't do that. They're too afraid to pull that trigger.
Absolutely. You've got another article over at the New American. Kennedy, this would be U.S. Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, ravages Roe. 1973 opinion should be overturned. Abortion is a state matter. Tell me about this article that you wrote, please.
Yeah, well, in this article, I do expound upon much that I was discussing here tonight. But absolutely, Kennedy, who's one of our very best senators, he was on the Senate floor giving a speech, and he was expressing pure and adulterated truth. He just said, listen, abortion, prenatal infanticide, as I like to call it, has always been a state matter. And that's what it should be under the Constitution. It's ridiculous to think that the Founding Fathers meant to include in the Constitution a right to kill your unborn baby. And even if you're someone who's pro-abortion, if you're intellectually honest at all, you ought to be able to see that point. The problem is that we have too many people now who want to view the Constitution as a living document. And on that basis, of course, they misrepresent it. And it's ridiculous. It's like saying the umpires in baseball can view the rules of baseball as living and then just make calls based upon their fancy. Ridiculous.
Yeah, they get to make up the laws that go along. But, you know, Americans don't get to make up the laws. They don't get to say, well, you know, the speed limit says 55, but I'm gonna just go 75 because I can make up my own laws. I mean,
it's living.
Yeah. What's that?
It's living. Yeah, it's living. The speed limit is living.
Yeah, it's living and breathing and evolving. You know, society evolves, morals evolve, the law evolves. Darwinian evolution applied to the law, you know, societal evolution. But yeah, but all of a sudden you get in the courtroom, the judge says, no, it's the speed was 55, you broke it. Boom. But the same court system is taking laws all the time that are just based on a whim of man's opinion. Well, if they can do what is right in their own eyes, why the heck can't I do what's right in my own eyes? See, that's the problem. They want to have a rules for thee and a rules for me, and then they decide what is right and wrong based on their own worldview. And that's not what the Constitution is about. The Constitution is to be the supreme law of the land. And of course, as you know, we've got judges writing laws all the time for the bench, but not to mention you got legislators writing laws that are automatically in a direct violation of the U.S. Constitution. So much of what the government's doing at the federal level isn't even in their preview to do.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, the late Professor Walter E. Williams, the economist, he died earlier this year, once estimated that about two-thirds of what the federal government is involved in, it is no constitutional warrant to be involved in. And he made that estimate years ago. It's probably greater, the percentage, by now. But let me say one thing about this idea of a living constitution, how ridiculous and how tyrannical it is. Our constitution can live, but the lawful way in which to make it live is called the amendment process.
Right.
If we find that it's lacking in some way, that maybe it has to be updated, and hopefully we're right when we make that decision, then what we can do is we can embark upon the amendment process, Brandon. And it ensures that before a change is made, there's widespread agreement on it. That's why the amendment process is so hard to affect. And that's the way it's supposed to be, because we're supposed to have a government of, by, and for the people. When these judges say the Constitution can live in their sense of it, well, what they're doing is they're taking it upon themselves to decide unilaterally, five justices maybe on the Supreme Court, when and how it's going to live. That's not a government of the people. That's an oligarchy of black-robed lawyers. And that's not what we're supposed to have.
Absolutely not. Let's go to a little bit of this audio and video of U.S. Senator Kennedy out of Louisiana on the Senate floor. Watch this.
President. Senator from Louisiana.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, we talk a lot in this chamber, as well we should, about the least amongst, about how we can protect and lift up the powerless. And that's a good thing. I can't think of any person who is less power than a potential human life, than an unborn baby. Now, Roe v. Wade is, of course, about abortion. We know that. But it's also about something else. Roe v. Wade is also about, it's about federalism. Roe v. Wade is also about the American people. Roe v. Wade is about whether a finite group of the managerial elite, and by the managerial elite, I mean the entrenched politicians, the bureaucracy, the media, the academics, the corporate phonies, all of whom think they're smarter and more virtuous than the American people, should have the right to make moral decisions for the American people instead of the American people making those decisions for themselves. That's really what Roe v. Wade is about. Now, Mr. President, I am I'm pro-life, and I am anti-Roe v. Wade. So I want to say up front, I do have an opinion. But Mr. President, even pro-choice legal scholars who believe in legalized abortion on demand understand, as does every fair-minded person who knows a law book from a J. Crew catalog, that Roe v. Wade is one of the most arbitrary, it's one of the most ad hoc, it's one of the most poorly reasoned decisions in the history of the United States. In Roe v. Wade, as you know, Mr. President, the United States Supreme Court held that a generalized right to privacy, not explicit in the Constitution, means that a woman has the virtually unfettered discretion to terminate a human life. Some, to be fair, would say a potential human life, before viability. What's viability? As my colleagues talked about, that's a really, really good question. But I digress. Anyone, Mr. President, who knows a law book from a J. Crew catalog also knows that there's absolutely no foundation, not in the text, not in the structure, not in the history, not in the tradition of the Constitution, for a constitutional right to abortion, and certainly not on the basis of some unmoored general right to privacy that's not enunciated in the Constitution.
U.S. Senator from Louisiana, I do like him. I like him a lot.
Yeah, yeah, he's the best. There's no doubt about
it. He gave the lady being picked for comptroller of the U.S. currency. He said, I don't know whether to call you comrade or what to call you. The pro-communist woman there. Remember that? That was great last
week.
Yeah, that was something.
Omarova is her name. Yes. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, she's like a James Bond villain out of a 1970s movie. I mean, she even has the Russian accent. You can't make this stuff up, Brandon.
That's right.
It's absolutely unbelievable. But. Getting back to what Senator Kennedy said, you know, it's very interesting. If you look at the history of the court, the federal courts in general, you'll see that they continually arrogate more power to themselves. I mean, the Obergefell ruling, or opinion, as I should call it, they got involved in marriage when that had always been understood to be a state issue. And what's happening here? Well, I think of what Lord Acton said. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The problem is we long ago gave the courts absolute power in the sense of having judicial supremacy, which is not in the Constitution, and they've started to run away with themselves more and more. And the court's wings need to be clipped. That's what has to happen. And there are ways to do that. Under the Constitution, the Congress actually could eliminate rogue federal courts, could do it, all except for the Supreme Court, and could limit the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, okay, appellate, I should say. But there's something else I want to point out. I said that judicial supremacy is not in the Constitution. If I were a governor, Brannon, and we had a law that I knew was absolutely constitutional relating to abortion or something else, I wouldn't care what the courts had to say. I would just say, listen, this is a just law. It's a constitutional law. I am head of the executive branch, therefore I have the power to affect the law, to enforce the law, and this law will be enforced. And I would paraphrase the paraphrase of Andrew Jackson and say, the courts have made their decision, now let them enforce it. That's what should be said. their courts are not supposed to have a complete and total say on the meaning of law and have their determinations constrain the other two branches as well, completely and totally, because if that's the case, then you no longer have a balance of power.
Absolutely. Selwyn Duke of The New American, as always, thank you for your great work and research and being a regular guest here, Selwyn.
Thank you, Brandon, and God bless.
You too. Selwyn Duke, thenewamerican.com.